piece I want to talk about, and then we'll hopefully have some time for any remaining questions or comments. But the last piece is around developing understanding and forgiveness, which is part of how sort of close the loop of suffering on this. This is Shanti Deva again. If those who, like wanton children, are by nature prone to injure others, what is the point in being angry? It's like resenting a fire for its heat. We start to see the ways that suffering works. So this is a path of understanding, of comprehending suffering, how it arises, how it fades away, how it spills out onto others and perpetuates itself. And part of this practice around understanding, around forgiveness, is getting clear on what is happening in the other. Yeah. This is Longfellow. If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. This is not to, again, to condone harm or to remove responsibility, but it is to see clearly what is happening in the heart mind of the other person, the way that they have failed to take good care of their anger in the way that we're training to do here today. Yeah? We're training to take good care of our anger. And when people do things that anger us, usually we are seeing the product of them not taking good care of their inner life. Not to absolve them, but we need to understand the causes, yeah? So there's a lot of talk about not self in Buddhism. We touched on it a bit. But the corollary of the teaching on not self is also the teaching on not other. And you can hear that in different ways. You can hear that as there occurs when the mind is open in such a way that the boundaries between the felt sense of I am and the rest of the world, that collapses. That's one way of cutting through the sense of separation. But what I'm talking about is a little different, which is when we are angry at someone else, it's like we want to pin that anger on the very essence of their being. Right? Like we make them wrong. Not like part of them, like we make their being wrong. We make their essence wrong, yeah? We try to like we essentialize them. In the same way the Buddha says we essentialize ourselves, essentialize meaning we try to locate an essence. It's me, it's Matthew, it's the Matthew inside of me. It's the Buddha says, no, coreless, coreless, coreless. That very sense of me is just more experience. That very sense of home base, that very sense of the place of self, that is more experience. That we need not think about our life in that way. And in fact, thinking about fixating the self in that way complicates everything. The corollary is not self, not other. When I was hating that supervisor, she's really been the prime target today. I wasn't planning on that. When I was in the middle of all that, the impulse was to make the wrongness about something very deep in her, rather than confusion, rather than pain, rather than conditioning, rather than, we want to watch that habit of essentializing the other. Another story from Ajahn Amaro. Student asked the teacher, I think maybe she was a nun, and she said, I'm going home for holiday Christmas break. I'm going to be spending time away from the monastery, away from all the protection of that. I'm going to be spending time with my family. And we don't have such an easy history. This may not be an easy vacation. What's your advice? How can I avoid getting into strife with my family? And what the teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, said was, he said, don't create them. The best way to be kind to your family is not to create them. What does that mean? I'm not certain, but I think what he was pointing to was that process of essentializing you who are bad to your core. At that core, the core is rotten. That is not what we find when we look deeply. And so, do not create them. Means do not fixate them as something with this enduring essence. That in so much of our anger, that is what's happening. We are turning them into an object. And concepts, they kind of do have an essence, but people, like concepts, in the world of concepts, good, bad, but it's not like that with people. When we look into their minds, into their lives, we can't find that core essence. When we look in, we find lots of conditions, lots of forces, conditioning, that habits that, if anything, lead us into a state of deeper understanding and ultimately compassion. So a few, in talking about forgiveness, it's maybe easiest to say a few things that it's not, because it gets confused with a lot. It is not an obligation. It's not condoning harm. It's not denial or suppression. It's not boundaryless, passivity. And it's not the same as reconciliation. So, it's not, to take them one at a time, it's not an obligation. It's not an obligation. You don't have to forgive someone. And you can't be forced to do it. You do it because you actually sense the burden on the heart created by the enduring resentment. You do it as much for oneself as for the relationship. And it might be that you don't even have a relationship. They might not be alive. They might not be welcome in your life. Stephen Levine said, you might forgiveness is letting them back into your heart, even if you might never let them back into your home. Yeah. Very different. It's not, I'm not proposing that everything can be all rosy or something, but this is the inner work of digesting our resentments. This is part of how the mind feels light. It's not embroiled in the loose ends of resentment. So this is not an obligation. This is something the heart leans towards. It's not condoning harm. That's a little what the online quote is pointing to. It's not saying that it's okay what you did. It's not forgive and forget. It may forgive, but we may remember. It's important to remember that that person's capable of real harm. I don't want to forget that. It's not denial or suppression, as we've talked about. It's not passivity. It's not, it's not something we do to get out of difficult conversations. Yeah. Sometimes we kind of paper over stuff by like, oh, I forgive them. Even though it may be important for us to do our own hard work or to have a conversation or whatever. And then it's not the same as reconciliation. It's the first step, we could say, in reconciliation, to forgive. But the reconciliation assumes that they want to participate too. Yeah? And that's not a given. That's their path. So this is Tenisaro Bhikkhu. When you forgive me for harming you, you decide not to retaliate, to seek no revenge. You don't have to like me. You simply unburden yourself of the weight of resentment and cut the cycle of retribution that would otherwise keep us ensnarled in an ugly, samsaric wrestling match. That's quite a phrase. You cut the cycle of retribution that would otherwise keep us ensnarled in an ugly, samsaric, suffering wrestling match. This is a gift you can give us both, totally on your own, without my having to know or understand what you've done. The Buddha admitted that not all disputes can be reconciled. There are times when one or both parties are unwilling to exercise the honesty and restraint that true reconciliation requires. Even then, though, forgiveness is still an option. This is why the distinction between reconciliation and forgiveness is so important. It encourages us not to settle for mere forgiveness when genuine healing and reconciliation is possible. And it allows us to be generous with our forgiveness even when it is not, when reconciliation is not possible. So we use our judgment about when reconciliation is possible. But in that process, our starting point, the practice, is something like forgiveness. And that practice takes lots of different forms. It, to some extent, it's these very reflections. It's days like this. It's practices like the one that you do. And it can be formalized to be a very specific practice. And Stephen Levine is somebody who's... It's not in the Pali canon, the forgiveness practice, but Stephen Levine and Jack Kornfield have done things like they've adapted loving-kindness type practices and incorporated forgiveness phrases. And, and forgiveness meaning asking forgiveness from others, you know, for harm that we've done, forgiving ourselves for harm we've done to ourselves, and accepting forgiveness from others. And so some of the phrases like for anything I've done intentionally or unintentionally that's caused harm, I ask your forgiveness. And you find your own words and your own way of practicing, but you're like marinating in that in the same way we do with metta practice. There's a gesture that happens at the end of retreats that the first time I encountered this was in reading about it, but I've since been the recipient and also offered the forgiveness. But at the end of retreats, sometimes, especially longer retreats, teachers will sometimes come down off like the dais and get down on the ground and, ask the forgiveness of the retreats, to say, for anything that I've done intentionally or unintentionally that's caused harm, I ask your forgiveness. And they'll bow and everybody's crying, and it's a way of keeping communities accountable, acknowledging any harm that may have been done, not intentionally, hopefully, but this is a very powerful practice. And for a lot of people, forgiveness practice is the prerequisite of metta and compassion. And sometimes the prerequisite of breath meditation, of satipatthana practice, of four foundations. We can't rush it, It's unpredictable how these things unfold. Often it's an enduring commitment that people make to the practice of forgiveness. But in your own practice, you might reflect, where is this needed? Where do I need to accept, imagine forgiveness for harm that's been done, for harm that we've done to others, we've done to ourselves? And we can reflect, how does this relate to our own anger? And how might the heart forgiving help us let go. The Buddha has one more thing that's very simple and interesting suggestion. It's maybe a last ditch effort. It's like we're all out of Dharma karate moves, you know, like we've done everything we can and we're all like, we're just out. We're out of moves. And this happened with it was not somebody I was close to, but there was somebody who was in a sangha, and my view was that they were. And it was a practice community I was just sitting with. And my view was that they kind of single-handedly sort of like created a schism in the Sangha, you know. And I'm definitely an anger type, like in the greed, hatred, delusion, like anger, aversion, that's my... If I'm going to suffer, that's how I'm going to do it, yeah. But I haven't been particularly prone to, like, enduring resentment. Like, I get angry and then, you know, if like, I do something with it, I practice with it, or I don't, but I forget about it. It's, like, really gone. And so... Except for the supervisor. No, I have. We're good. We're good. We hugged and everything. So I'm angry with this, and first there's the acute phase of anger, and then, you know, and it was like it happened in a sangha, so it's like so obvious, okay, Matthew, practice with this. It's not like in another setting, so it's like, okay, here we go. So I practiced with it, whatever, and it sort of like faded, but it didn't fade totally. It really didn't fade totally. And I would get periodically emails from the nonprofit organization that he's involved with, the Dharma organization. And every time I would see that email in my inbox, just like a little internal clench, like, yeah, I don't like that. And, you know, like the ember of resentment was still... You know, still there, and this, I don't know, this was like many years ago, but I remember I got one email from him, and I remembered some counsel the Buddha gave, the last ditch advice, which is, if you can't let go, give them a gift. Which is very counterintuitive, you know, it's like working against all of the habits of anger, right? So I got that email and that story, that advice came to mind, and I was like, you know what? I am making a donation to this nonprofit. I don't want to, but... This is, it's enough resentment. This is nuts. And so I gave a little bit of money, and it was honestly actually quite helpful. And there was something about it was like sometimes the body follows the mind, like we have an intention and then the rest of us follows along. But sometimes we just do something and then the mind follows, yeah? It's like I did not have a wholesome, the painful. But it was not, the intention was not pure. It was not true dana, you know. But there was something that was actually transformed in that gesture. It like cut through something. I don't know exactly why it was helpful, but it actually did set all that up. So, yes, yeah, please.
In your mind,
in the sense that it was, the resentment like disappeared or faded almost entirely. Yeah. That's maybe not the most inspiring story to end on, but that's where we are. Anyway, I wanted to leave a little bit of time for anything that's remaining, anything that's on your mind. Yeah.
Could you speak something to the it's an interpersonal thing, but of the, not so much you having anger about something, but of you needing to bring up something to someone else that you know will provoke anger. Mm.
Yeah. It's a good question, and I don't really know. But I'll still talk. The only thing that comes to mind is that we are, I guess, two things. We're really clear on our intention. We have purified our intention. We're bringing a lot of wisdom and love to the situation. We're saying this because we know it needs to be said, needs to be done. And we're clear that that this intention is actually for the benefit of this person, the relationship. Yeah. And the other piece is, how steady can we be in the midst of the anger of another? Those are related skills. How steady can we be with our own anger? How steady can we be in the face of anger? Yeah? And like Jung says, we can't go places with people unless we've been there, you know? And so our own practice is to learn to tolerate, to bear with, to remain steady, to have some sense of safety amidst the intense winds of anger. And then we call on that same kind of steadiness to be there when the other person may get angry. And we do everything we can, I think, to raise the issue in a way that's not likely to evoke defensiveness. We develop a history of goodwill across the weeks, months, years. That's part of how our conduct, our good sila functions, is that we have money in the bank, yeah? So when we come to people with something, they know we are not indulging in suffering. It's because we need to do it, yeah? So we come with a kind of clear heart, as clear as we can be, and then we are asked to do what we can to tolerate the anger, hatred that arises. And, you know, this is especially poignant in the case of parent-child relationships, where it's the parent's job to tolerate the hatred, to contain it, you know, to not hold on to it or something, but actually to contain it, to be steady enough in oneself that it hurts, but it doesn't destabilize us. It doesn't chase us away. It doesn't close our heart to them. And they get that actually sense that we can weather, yeah? Yeah.
I don't remember the exact story of some person in the Buddha's time who came to the Buddha and was going to kill him. And this is what you described, you know, that he was able to, I think it was a king or somebody who was saying, "You're not so great, I could cut off your head with one, you know, thing like that," you know, but and try to, you know, just goad him into, you know, being afraid of him. And the Buddha's response was something to the effect of, "You're the one that's, you know, I am not, you cannot harm me because I'm not afraid," or something of that nature, you know, which really is a powerful story, because I appreciate your comment. It's often hard for me to be steady when you're being, you know, attacked, especially if it's someone, a younger person that, you know, has no, you know, as you pointed out, a parent-child relationship, you know, when you're getting all this hate towards you and you just have to remain grounded and in the face of it. Because if you, one of my big issues with anger is I don't want to provoke people. You know, I know where their trigger points are, and so I kind of walk on eggshells around certain people, which I don't think is very skillful. You know, I realize it just makes me resentful of the person, that I feel like I have to, you know, be very careful of how I phrase things to and that sort of thing. But I don't know if is that fear of anger or fear of the relationship dissolving or
It might be. It sounds like it. It sounds like you have a bit of a beat on it. Like what's happening?
Well, in the case of your supervisor, I mean, you talk about, you know, deciding that you had to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Did you experience a lot of fear and trepidation before you actually had the conversation, or was it pretty
clear? I did. You know, I haven't had many of those conversations in my life, but I remember being pretty nervous before that, yeah. But it was, I don't think it's always appropriate. I knew she was capable of it. If I approached it in a really non-defensive way, which was to take full responsibility, you know, and make sure that she was not on her heels, basically. And in doing that, I had confidence that we could find our way, but I was definitely nervous. And it would not have resolved without the conversation. It needed to happen.
The people were very explosive in their anger. You know, there's that fear that you could actually be physically harmed if you, you know, such as in these situations like road rage, and, you know, where people actually do attack people physically. There's lots of anger. So how do you judge that in the other person? You have to know that person, I guess, pretty well before you would...
Yeah, you definitely got to be strategic in when you have conversations and when you just let go,
Okay.
Your story reminded me of the story, maybe it was on Guli Mala in the Buddha, But there's a Zen story. The Zen folks have lots of great stories. And I think it was a samurai who came up to a Zen master, and the samurai, you know, is like the sword and super macho, and you know, and the samurai says to the Zen master, like, tell me all about heaven and hell. And the Zen master says, I could never tell you, somebody like you of your low class and stupidity, like, I could never explain the truth about heaven and hell to somebody like you. And the samurai, like, raises the sword to kill the Zen master, right? And the Zen master says, that is hell. the samurai gets,
right,
puts down the sword, starts crying, bows, then it's death. It's heaven.
About when you said you had that talk with your supervisor, sorry, the girl, that you took ownership of it, and do you think maybe you didn't take ownership of the conflict, but you took ownership of your anger, and that gave her a chance to look at her own anger?
I erred on the side of taking too much ownership.
Okay.
Too much rather than too little, you know?
Yeah.
I made it very, in the opening to that conversation, there was no sense of, I was not asking her to take responsibility for anything, because she was a pretty troubled person, and so really defensive, and we just had a weird thing, and so I knew if I came to her with asking for something, it would likely provoke some of the same stuff that we had going on. So I erred on the side of taking more responsibility, and it was through that, creating that kind of sense of emotional safety for her in the conversation, that she was then able to say, like, you know, I've been mistreating you, actually. And then there's an opening, and then we both feel like we're both being accountable, and then it's like the door of kindness and compassion opens again, but it's closed when we're really on our heels. And so how we start those conversations, it's really important. Like, how do we start those conversations? What do we say, you know?
Well, it seems to me, too, since as you were saying that, it seemed like your motivation, and I can see this in, you know, some of the conversations that people have had, your motivation wasn't getting her to admit she was wrong, but getting to a place of resolution.
Maybe
that made all the difference.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. You're right, I was no longer interested in being right, which is really important, yeah. Yeah, it's really, like, yeah, that's a whole other topic, but, like, being attached to being right, that's a disease, you know, it's like,
it's good to separate the anger from the need to be right, anger and the need to be right don't have to go hand in hand.
Okay, it was so unusual in the way that you approached your supervisor. I don't think that's done, certainly not in my realm of experience, you know, a lot. So I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to repeat what it was that you said to her. You told us earlier in this kind of head.
I don't remember exactly, but it was something like, it was something along the lines of, I have been unskillful in these ways. I regret that. And I want to find a way forward in this relationship to work more effectively together. And, those were, I think, the basic sort of elements. But I remember in framing the conversation, I was aware, sort of moment by moment, of her sensitivities. Yeah, like, and we have to be aware of that. It doesn't mean we don't, you know, have the conversation, but we've got to be, like, really attuned, empathically aware of all of the hard points in the other. Yeah, and we care for those. I mean, this is not just for conversation around anger. This is in a lot of conversations. We actually, part of how people come to trust us is that we don't press on the hard points, you know? Like, we actually can sense what gets them defensive and in oppositional. And that's suffering from them. And they may not be able to, they may not be trained to deal with that effectively. Yeah. Some of what we're doing here is being trained to deal when the hard points get poked. Our training kicks in. Yeah, but doesn't always work. Yeah. And so to be really careful with that, I remember trying to take very good care of that so as to get the ball rolling. And then once there was that first opening, she was willing to take a lot of responsibility. But if the conversation starts with me demanding it, yeah. Sure. So, gotta wrap up. Let me just sit for a second. Just sensing that part of the heart mind really longs to be at peace, to be a cause of peace. But there's something in us that really deeply wishes not to harm. That which in us which longs for peace and ease. We may not always know how to create peace, but the longing itself is very innocent. We come to be moved by this longing to be happy, moved by the poignancy of being alive, and so whatever goodness you sense in the room today, together, may this remind you of your own goodness. And may that connection with the sense of your own goodness be the seed, the thread in the world. May whatever joy or peace, kindness that is ours, may this be of benefit for all that we encounter. Thank you. really nice to spend the day together. Appreciate it. Thanks, Lori, and got this church with this words, and yeah, very sweet. So, anyway, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.